I said in closing that we would take a little bit of time for questions. In the break, one question came forward. What do you mean by holistic? I don't know what that word means. So you can feel free to wave your hand and stop me if I use words that are too big or that you don't understand. That's my problem, not yours. And if you're wondering, somebody else is probably wondering about that too. What I mean by holistic is simply we need to consider all the aspects of who we are as people, psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, physically. Sometimes when people hear the word holistic, they think Eastern religion, they think yoga, they think, you know, sitting. My son, I forget what happened. I was, one of them has some anxiety, and so I said, okay, son, you're getting wound up here. We're going to take a deep breath. And he says, oh, Dad. And he sits down on the floor. He crosses his legs and he goes, you mean Dad like this? Hum. And I'm like, son, where in the world did you learn that? We don't take him to yoga classes or, oh, we said it's all over the place. Like, get with it, Dad. So when I use the word holistic, I am not referring to or encouraging participation in Eastern religions. So that is something to be aware of. When I say holistic, I mean overall. Don't overlook any aspect of who we are as a person. I heard a story recently. This was a psychiatrist. He was working with an individual who had schizoaffective disorder, which is a peculiarly difficult chronic disorder. So you're having thought disorder, it's hallucinations, delusions, along with mania, depression. It's kind of a mixture of schizophrenia and bipolar. And he had been through all kinds of medication, couldn't get help, was way overweight, went to a psychiatrist and said, can you help me lose weight? And the psychiatrist said, okay, we're going to try this pretty crazy diet. It was an extreme diet. I don't remember which one it was, but some huge dietary changes. And after being on that for 3, 4, 5, 6 months, his schizoaffective symptoms started going away. And so the psychiatrist started asking questions like, what? Are we missing something here in terms of people's gut health and in terms of diet, in terms of treating schizoaffective disorder or thought disorders or bipolar? So they're... Again, that's anecdotal, right? And so now this psychiatrist is starting studies at Hopkins and UCLA and a variety of other places to try to better understand that. If somebody comes into me with bipolar, I'm not going to say, don't try a diet, but that's not the only thing I'm going to say, right? And it's probably not the first thing that I'm going to say. So we need to be open to considering all of these things, but to do so with an understanding of what generally works for many people, and then what does faith look like for you, and what are you willing to engage and step out into. So that's what I mean by holistic. Any other questions? We're going to get started, and we're going to jump into what's this experience of OCD like, and do that diagnostically, but then also experientially. But before we do that, questions about mental health, the session that I was just through. And there are no bad questions. Now, I will say we are recording this, and so if it's a question, I may repeat it just so that those who listen to the recording can hear it. And if it ends up being that there's some back and forth discussion, we may pass you a mic. Feel free. There are no bad questions. In a setting like this, when we're talking about OCD, you may be somebody who struggles with OCD yourself. You may know somebody who does. So keep in mind that we are recording this. And if you're going to talk about somebody who has that experience, be mindful and respectful of that so you're not recording somebody else's story without their permission. Does that make sense? Okay, question. Yes, I didn't go over that. Ideographic and nomothetic norms. So ideographic norms have to do with norms that are specific to the particular person, and then nomothetic is norms that are specific to the general population. And I'm using words there that are pretty big, but let me explain. And I'll use the example of going to the dentist, and they say, we want to give you x-rays. And I say, well, I thought the people that invented x-rays got cancer from having x-rays put through them, so how is this good for me to get x-rays? And they say, well, we've studied the population in general. We've looked at 100,000 people that have come into the dentist, and we know that 60%, I'm making these numbers up, this probably isn't true, 60% of them don't brush their teeth very well, and so they get cavities. And so if we take x-rays on the whole population every year or every 6 months or every 2 years, whatever the numbers are, we can reduce the level of incidence of cavities in the general population. And so when everybody comes in, we're going to tell everybody, because we've done this study at the population level, that you are likely to have less cavities if we give you an x-ray every 2 years. And we've studied it, and very few people that have x-rays get brain tumors from them. And so every 2 years, you should have x-rays. That's what's true of the general population. That is a nomothetic norm. Okay? You look at the whole population and we say this is what's true for everybody. An ideographic norm is what is true for you specifically. So if you're part of the 40% that really brushes your teeth and you haven't had a cavity in 15 years and you have really hard teeth, you might not be likely to have a cavity in another 15 years. So maybe it will be better for you to only have an x-ray every 5 years. And so you would say, based on ideographic norms, based on what's good for people who brush their teeth, I don't think I need to have as many x-rays as somebody who isn't brushing their teeth, what's true of the general population. So if we think about that in terms of mental health meds, bipolar disorder, for example, lithium, there are other medications that are often prescribed at the general, when we look at everybody who has bipolar disorder, we know that lithium is pretty effective in tampering down the mania and bringing up the lows. We've given it for years and years and years. And generally speaking, if somebody has a well-diagnosed, a legitimate bipolar disorder, lithium or other mood stabilizers can be helpful for that. There are some people who are far more sensitive to medication than others. Some people can take one ibuprofen and it takes care of it. Some people have to take three or four to get the same effect. Our body metabolizes things differently. And so you could be a person who lithium doesn't work at all. You have a very bad reaction to it, right? Or you only need a little bit. Or you need another kind of medication on bipolar. So what's true nomothetically might not be true ideographically for you personally. So when I'm saying know the person in front of you, you need to have wisdom. You need to understand what's their history. And how do they react to medication? How do they think about medication? When I worked in the hospital, for example, there were people that would come in and they would say to the psychiatrist, give me a pill. I've got this anxiety. You've got to make it go away. And they've already tried 10. And the psychiatrist is saying, you need counseling. You need to work on the way you think. You need to do things to calm down your anxiety. No, 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 no. There's a medication. Give me a medication. And you get to know the person and you find out that they have an addictive personality. They've been involved in other addictions. And so we begin to understand, oh, medication for this person, they're much more likely to get addicted to medication than somebody who's very resistant and wants to stay away from it. And so the psychiatrist, if he's a wise one, many of the psychiatrists I worked with were, they would look at this person and they would say, okay, given what I know about you, this is what I'm going to prescribe. I'm going to prescribe a medication that's less addictive, or I'm not going to prescribe as much as you want, or I'm going to, because I know the person in front of me. There might be somebody who's really resistant to medication, and you get to know that. Well, they might be able to use some that are more addictive because of their internal resistance. They're less likely to get addicted to it, and so they might be able to use that particular medication that this person isn't. And okay, that's not your job to figure out. That's a psychiatrist's job. But in other categories, we need to know the person in front of us when we're making particular recommendations or thinking through how do we help this person. Does that make sense?
Yes. Thank
you. Other questions?
Expand on the thought of holding the two contradictory thoughts.
holding two contradictory thoughts together. Our muscles and our bones hold our body upright because they're in tension, right? And there are truths that we sometimes hold in tension that we don't entirely resolve. And maybe I should say the question for the purpose of the recording. Maybe I forgot to do that on the last one. Expand a little bit on holding two contradictory truths together. I'll just use an example of medication, for example. Take an SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, that is often first line of treatment for major depressive disorder. We don't know exactly how SSRIs work, but a lot of study, a lot of what has been taught, we are now finding out doesn't work exactly the way that we thought it did. They've done large studies using SSRIs on depression. And for major depressive disorder, I don't want to generalize this to, excuse me, all mental health medications, but for major depressive disorder, antidepressants, specifically SSRIs, have not been shown to be effective above placebo for mildly or moderately depressed people. They have been shown to be effective for people who are major, who have severe depression. So as a clinician, somebody comes into me with major depressive disorder, and I know this, and I'm going to begin thinking about what's going on, what's causing the depression. We're going to work with the way their mind is working. We're going to take that holistic approach that I was talking about. And I'm going to hold in the back of my mind this tension between, I know that SSRIs don't work for some people, but they do work for people who are severely depressed. And so at what point do we give that medication to that person? Depending on how badly depressed they are, I might say we're going to start off with that. You know, I don't think you're able to engage counseling until, and so let's try medication. We'll check all the other physical things that are going on. And then we say, okay. But in the back of my mind, I'm also holding this tension of, some people have side effects, right? The medication doesn't work for everybody. And so we have to take into consideration their tensions in the middle of that too. Can they take it in faith, right? And maybe we'll do a trial for 6 months or whatever the doctor recommends and see what the impact is. And if it's helpful, maybe they continue on that. If it's not, maybe we go to something else. So I'm just saying we can't make black and white statements about SSRIs are always helpful. SSRIs are not always. We hold those things in tension, and then we walk in faith, and we help the person make a decision. And that should be true about any particular kind of therapy that we're going to use. Is that helpful? Okay, another question. So I will talk specifically in regards to OCD as we go along, and then in our last session together. The question was, I've talked about humble relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ, helping the person to walk in that. And the question was, how do we help a person to practically do that? Because we're talking about OCD, I will flesh that out as we go through the talk about OCD. If we're going to talk about the particular category, other categories of mental health, there are ways to do that as well. But I would want to help tailor that to the person's particular experience. Excellent question. Maybe it feels like I'm not answering it, but I'll flesh that out in terms of OCD. And maybe over lunchtime, we can talk about that more generally in other categories. Thank you. Anybody else? Okay, let's jump into what this experience of OCD is like. You can turn in your manuals to where it says session two. What is the struggle with, what is it like to struggle with the experience of OCD? So you have in front of you here A, B, C, and D. This is taken directly from the DSM-5. So these are criteria that I would use to diagnose somebody. And I'm going to read through this quickly, not because it will give you the experience, but I want you to hear what things I'm going to have to look for as a clinician if I am going to diagnose somebody with the experience of obsessive-compulsive disorder. Presence of obsessions, compulsions, or both. And these are recurrent, persistent thoughts, urges, or images that are experienced as intrusive and unwanted. So they are thoughts that come into a person's mind. The person doesn't want to have this experience, and the thought causes them distress. They try to ignore or suppress these thoughts or images, or they do something to neutralize them. Compulsions, on the other hand, so that's an obsession. Compulsions are repetitive behaviors, hand-washing, ordering, checking. We'll talk about more of those. Or mental acts. Sometimes the OCD happens inside a person's mind, and you can't always see in their behaviors. Repetitive behaviors, the individual feels driven to perform in response to an obsession or according to rules that must be applied rigidly. The behaviors or mental acts are aimed at preventing or reducing anxiety or distress. The behaviors or mental acts are not connected in a realistic way with what they are designed to neutralize or prevent, and they're clearly excessive. The obsessions or compulsions are time-consuming, and they're not attributable to physiological effects of a substance. So you have to rule out that they're using some sort of a street drug or other kinds of things that could be causing similar experiences. Now, we're going to jump into what obsessions and compulsions are, what they look like. So I'm sure those definitions raise a lot of questions, and we'll unpack that. But before we jump into that, let's talk about prevalence. Something like 1 to 2% of the population. So we got a room here of 200 people. If you look around, and this is the size of your church on a Sunday morning, that means probably 4 people in your congregation are going to have this experience. And that it would rise to a level that's diagnosable. There might be other ones who have similar experiences, but we wouldn't say it's clinically diagnosable. Typical age of onset is by 20 years. So by the time you're 20, you'll typically see this. 25% start by the age of 14. Females are affected at a slightly higher rate than males in adulthood. Males are more commonly affected in childhood. The development of the disorder. So if you have this experience and you don't get good treatment for it, 80% of the individuals who don't get treatment are going to have this experience throughout their life. So we find somebody by the age of 20 who has it. By the time they're 60, 80% of the people are still going to have that experience, and for many it will get worse unless they get into some sort of therapy. So that means 20% of the people who have those symptoms, it goes away by over the course of 40 years. That's not, I wouldn't bet on that because it often gets worse. That's not a reason to stay out of treatment, but just for some people it does resolve. Onset in childhood or adolescence. So if you get it when you're younger, if you have this experience when you are a child, it's more likely that it's going to be more severe and go with you through life than if you get it as an adult. Prognostic factors. So when we think about personality, what kind of people are more likely to develop this kind of experience? Greater internalizing of symptoms. So when somebody has an experience, do they take it inside them and make it about themselves? If that's a personality characteristic, higher negative emotionality. Some people are more reactive. You know, you have somebody who will have an experience and, you know, you get lots of that. Somebody else can have the same experience and they say, well, I guess that's going to hurt a little bit, you know, and they move on. Those are differences. And if you're the more reactive kind, more likely that's a risk factor. Behavioral inhibition, childhood trauma. So we have seen cases where somebody has a sexual abuse experience or another kind of traumatic event and immediately develops obsessive-compulsive symptoms. It can be a way of dealing with that sense of internal uncomfortability of what's going on. I wouldn't say that trauma certainly doesn't always create OCD, and OCD can develop without trauma, but there are some anecdotal evidence for that. Certain ethics values. So sometimes people will say, does bad parenting cause OCD? You know, or did I grow up in a family, right? Parents come and say, my son, daughter struggles with OCD. Did I do something wrong that caused this? And I would say no. I have seen people with OCD from families that you say, this is a well-functioning family. I have seen it in families where you say, okay, there's some dynamics here that need to be addressed. So I will say more about this, but I tend to think about OCD as being more neurologically driven than behaviorally driven. Can you, as parents or as a family, do things that perpetuate the OCD or that make it worse if you don't understand what's going on? Yes, definitely. And so you need to understand how to work with it and what's going on. But I tend to steer away from there's something relationally going on in this family. Now, some families, I don't know that I could say this is always the case, but I have seen some families that tend to be a little more perfectionistic. That's just their style. I think that that could contribute and maybe amp things up. And so maybe they have to think about how do we become more relaxed or how do we... But that doesn't cause the OCD. Genetic and physiologically. So there is a genetic component to OCD. If you have a family member or a relative who has OCD, you're twice as likely to have it yourself as the general population. If that person had the disorder before the age of 14, you're 10 times more likely to have OCD. So there is a genetic component to this. It occurs throughout cultures across the world. It might be expressed differently based on the particular culture, but this is a common experience. So I talked about risk factors before, situational personality characteristics, upright, moral, high standards. This is in your notes. Fearful, introspective, depressive, risk averse, tendency to avoid harm, lack of interest in novelty, great need for approval from others. And then two I have in bold here, excessive personal responsibility, overimportance of thoughts. These are two personality characteristics that if these are true about you, you are much more likely to struggle with this experience of OCD. Fearfulness, introversion, somebody who's perfectionistic, punctual, aloof, inflexible, intolerant. Those are things that will crank up the likelihood that you might have OCD. It doesn't mean, I mean, you can be somebody who that describes you and you don't have OCD, but those characteristics are probably going to be present when somebody comes in and says, I have OCD. An inflated sense of personal responsibility, a deep-seated automatic tendency to feel accountable for anything bad that might happen. I'm quoting from Osborne there. Those are two characteristics that he would say are almost always true. You've heard the term oversensitive conscience, and we'll talk about that more when we get to religious scrupulosity. Those are characteristics that go along with this. I want to say a little bit about the neurobiological. So there is a genetic predisposition. We've seen brain trauma trigger OCD, in particular when the basal ganglia, the little sections deep within the brain, are impacted. OCD symptoms will sometimes occur. There are many, many studies that have been done about OCD. One of those looked at the way a baby develops in the womb. So after conception, the DNA from the man and the woman come together, and then the cells begin to replicate. And the first thing that gets laid out, the first thing that gets built, is your spinal. Your spinal column, the neurology inside of that, your brain and your spinal cord. And the first part of that that develops, if you're looking at a brain, is this basal part, the bottom part, the brain stem that's connected to the spinal cord. And that part of the brain is responsible for instinct, for urges, things that we don't all have entire control over with the other parts of our brain. So you think about things like keeping your heart going. We think about hormonal kinds of things. We think about digestive processes, all these processes that our body just does are regulated by that first part of the brain that develops. Sexual urges, impulses are created there. The prefrontal part of our brain that sits up here behind our temples is the last part of the brain to develop, and it's not fully developed until you're 25. And so this is why teenagers ramp their BMX bikes off of high things. Whee! Right? And then on the way down, they think, this might hurt, you know, or maybe they don't think till after they get down. The first part of the brain to develop creates that instinct, that impulse. Let's do this, right? The part of the brain that says, ouch, might hurt, isn't quite there yet. And by the time you get to be 25, you've had enough of those experiences. And so there is some thought, one of the theories about OCD, is that this part of the brain that creates instinct is somehow more powerful in people with OCD than it is in ones who aren't, and maybe the part of the brain that we might think of as the brakes that holds back those higher order executive functions that says, ah, that might hurt, do you really want to do this, isn't as strong. Sounds like a nice theory, but our brain is far more complex than that. And they've done imaging studies, and they'll say, oh, OCD, this part of the brain is a little bigger, or there's more gray matter, or less. And yeah, that's true with everybody that has OCD. But then they find somebody who doesn't have OCD, and they have those same abnormalities. So it's not a perfect science. We can't say there's this particular gene that if you have, and if it's turned on, you will have OCD. They've looked at fMRI studies, what parts of the brain light up when somebody's stuck in an obsessive ritual, a compulsive ritual. And there are parts of the brain that light up in ways that are different than those who don't have OCD. And so all of this to say, I think that with OCD it can be helpful to say there's sufficient neurological basis to understand my brain is making me do this, and it's not really who I am, right? We can blame a bit of this on our neurology. Now, we still have to deal with it. That doesn't excuse responsibility. There are also neurochemical things that are going on. So serotonin abnormalities due to studies showing that people who use this medication improve over placebo. We have a group of people with OCD, we give them an SSRI, and they get better at a much better rate than those who don't have the medication. And so we think, we don't know everything about how serotonin works, but if we can increase those levels, if we can alter those levels in some ways, then it's easier for them to manage those thoughts. So there's something neurophysiological going on there. So the takeaway, this is something my brain is causing me to experience. It might not be what's most true about me or who I really am. Now, how do we, as a Christian worldview, how do we make sense of this kind of an understanding? Well, here's one way. My body can make me very uncomfortable, but it can't make me sin. Christ's death on the cross is sufficient for both my sin and my suffering. And I'll unpack that more as we go along. Obsessions and compulsions. Let's jump in. What is an obsession? It's an intrusive thought. It's recurrent. It's something I don't want, and it's inappropriate. I'm worried that I'm going to get sick if I get germs on my hands, and I might give that illness to you, and you might die, and so I'm going to wash my hands to keep you from dying. Maybe once. But if I have to do that 100 times a day in order to be okay, now I'm causing other problems. So here's some common obsessions. Maybe I didn't tell the truth. Maybe I will abuse my son or daughter. Maybe my heart had a sinful motive. Maybe I didn't turn off the stove and the house is going to burn down. These are common obsessions that people have. What's a compulsion? A compulsion is a repetitive behavior or a thought, and it's engaged in for the purpose of lowering anxiety. Think about this for a moment. An obsession comes into my mind, and that thought, if I don't wash my hands, I might be responsible for your death. Okay, that thought gets stuck in my head. I like you. I don't want to be responsible for your death, so my anxiety goes up. And now I'm going to do something to bring that anxiety down because I can't tolerate that anxiety. And so I engage in the compulsion. Maybe if I wash my hands, I will feel better because I'm doing something to prevent the unwanted outcome. So I wash my hands and immediately that obsession comes down. The anxiety caused by that obsession comes down. You with me here? So when people are doing a compulsion, they are not really doing it because they don't want to make you sick. They're doing it to lower that internal feeling of anxiety, that alarm system in the brain that is going off and it's screaming at them and they've got to do something to stop it. So here are some compulsions. I must say a prayer. I need to wash my hands. I have to mentally recount every minute of the last hour so I can prove I did not abuse my child. I had a client who was worried. He was obsessed over the fact that he was going to molest one of his children. And so, I mean, can you imagine as a dad, like, you keep a wide berth from them. Well, as a dad, we need to pick our children up. We need to hug them. We need to read books to them. We need to jump on the trampoline. He gets close to him and these thoughts come in, I'm going to sexually molest him or her. That's an incredibly troubling thought to have. You don't want to do that as a dad. And so his particular compulsion, what he does to lower that anxiety, what he would think about the last hour, every minute of the last hour to make sure that I didn't do something to my son or daughter. Why is he doing that? It doesn't make any sense. The last hour is already done. Why are you thinking about that? Well, because then I can prove to myself that I'm not a pedophile or I'm not going to do this by thinking about that. It's not logically connected, but he's doing it to bring that anxiety down. Need to ask forgiveness to cover the possibility of a sinful motive. I need to count to 10, looking at the stove, so I can be sure the stove is off so the house won't burn down. How many of you check the stove when you leave the house? Put your hands up high. I won't diagnose you with OCD. You can check the stove when you leave the house. I check it twice sometimes. If you have to stand there for 20 minutes, though, and check it over and over again and get through a ritual of counting to 10, there's a problem. Part of the problem, part of the way we think about this is that it's a demand for certainty. I can't live with the possibility that I might leave the house and the house might burn down. And then what? That would be awful. And so I am going to demand that uncertainty goes away. You see the perfectionistic tendencies. I've got to do something so I can be sure, for sure, for sure. And so some people, you know, that's an internal process. We'll talk about that more in the mind. Some people will do reassurance seeking where, so I'm leaving the house and I'll ask my wife, oh, I locked the door. I didn't check the stove. Honey, did you check the stove? Right? And she can say, yes, I did. It's fine. We go on our way to church on a Sunday morning. Now, if I have to lead her around the house and say, is the stove off? Is the light switch off? Is the bathroom door closed? And that ritual takes 20 minutes. Now I'm asking her to lower my anxiety by doing all of those things as we walk around the house. That's called reassurance seeking. And we'll talk more about this when we get into how families respond. Families can get pulled into perpetuating this kind of a problem because they think they're helping. My wife says, yeah, I turned the stove off. No, you don't need to check the light switch. I did. I feel better. And then we can go to church. And so they participate in these kinds of behaviors. Typical stories. So a person who brushes his teeth until his gums bleed and his teeth fall out because he's worried he will get cavities if he doesn't brush. I had a client once who was worried about doing that. You know, am I going to get cavities? And so he would brush his teeth. And the dentist was saying, you've got to stop brushing your teeth. Like he was brushing his gums away. The gums were bleeding and receding. You irritate your gums enough like that, they will actually go away. And the dentist said, you're going to lose your teeth. It'd be better for you to get some cavities. You need to stop. What dentist tells you to stop brushing your teeth, right? It wasn't about brushing his teeth. It was about his mind getting fixated. Cavities are terrible. I don't like going to the dentist. I mean, who likes going to the dentist? I don't want them drilling around in there, so I'm going to brush my teeth. but he couldn't lay it down after 2 minutes. A man who washes his hands until they bleed. A woman who counts over and over again for 30 minutes before going to bed because she needs to convince herself the door is locked, the light switch is out, the stove is not left on. A lady who repeatedly asks church members for forgiveness because she's worried she might have slighted them. We all say things that we shouldn't, you know, to each other in the context of life. And you all know what it's like to go back and apologize and say, I'm sorry, I didn't think about, or I was reacting to something and it really wasn't about you, or that just wasn't kind. Can you forgive me? Excuse me. When that starts happening 10, 15, 20 times and the person you're going to talk to is irritated, like, don't come and talk to me about this. So we think that Martin Luther probably had obsessive compulsive disorder, and there are books that are being written about that. It's interesting to think about how that would have developed his particular theology. But one of his experiences, so they had the confessor that you go to who sits behind the screen, and he's a representation of God. And so you confess your sins to him. Father, forgive me. And then you list your sins. And then the priest says, you've spoken this to me. You are forgiven. You can go on your way. Well, Martin Luther would spend 8 hours confessing his sins. And the priest would get irritated and say, Martin Luther, off with you. Be gone. I am tired of hearing your sins anymore. This was an obsessive, compulsive process. It was not really about sins that he needed to confess. He could have done that for days, probably. The person who believes he's committed the unpardonable sin and he'll go to hell because he's unable to stop curse words from going through his mind. That's a peculiar and very difficult way to suffer, right? Curse words popping into your mind that you don't want, that you can't get out of your mind, that just keep coming over and over and over again. And so then people will engage in compulsions. Often it's an internal prayer. Jesus, forgive me. Other kinds of mental rituals to lower that anxiety because they're having that experience. The young lady who can't put the clean towels in the drawer because it takes too much time to make sure each item is properly folded. You know, I have a daughter, and she likes to fold the laundry, and it is done to a T. I mean, everything, perfect, square, uniform, and I don't think she has OCD. But I can kind of picture, and I've had clients this way who then take the towels to put away in the drawer, and they look at the drawer, and it's, okay, if I don't color code these towels, if I don't get them in the drawer in just the right order, I won't be able to find the particular one that I need. And so I have to make sure they're all folded just right. And that process of checking can take 20 minutes or a half hour, and so the towels never get folded. And then what starts to happen is the laundry basket sits there because they know the anxiety that's going to come up from having to take those and put them in the drawer is so great that it's going to take a half hour, and they don't want to waste that time, so we just don't put the towels in the drawer. Do you see how this is not about the towels, right? It's about that process in the mind and the anxiety that's coming up when their brain fixates in an obsessive way on, I won't be able to find the towel that I want when I need it if it's not folded right, color-coded, and put it in the exact spot. And so that's an uncomfortable feeling. So what am I going to do? I'm going to start checking. But then the checking takes 20 minutes or a half hour. John Bunyan was another person who we think probably had obsessive-compulsive disorder. Listen to a quote from him. I began to think, he's standing next to a church, what if one of the bells should fall? So, I chose to stand under a main beam, thinking that there I might stand safely. But then I thought again, what if the bell fell with a swing? It might first hit the wall, and then bouncing, rebound upon me and kill me, despite the fact that I'm standing under the beam. So this made me stand in the steeple door, And now I thought, whew, finally I am safe enough. But then it came into my head, what if the steeple itself should fall? And this started constantly so to shake my mind that I dare not stand at the steeple door any longer, but was forced to flee for fear the steeple should fall upon my head. You see what's happening there? Right? It's not really about the bell falling. It's about the anxiety that's being caused and him trying to manage it and then that not working. And I want to say a little bit, when somebody engages in a compulsion, it is very, very effective. One of the most effective ways to bring your anxiety down when you're having this obsessive thought is to do the thing that seems like it's going to prevent the unwanted outcome. I don't want to get sick. I don't want to make you sick. So my anxiety is going up because I'm worried about that. I will wash my hands. And when I wash my hands, this neurochemical process floods my brain that quiets my anxiety down and I feel better right away. It's a powerfully addictive process. And so people do it over and over and over again. The problem is it only works for a moment because that anxiety comes back. Well, what if I get another germ, right? John Bunyan, well, the bell might swing and bounce off the wall and come in and get me. And so people are trying to manage that anxiety. And while engaging in the compulsion is effective, it's only effective for a moment. It doesn't help in the long run. And so this is why we have to begin to think differently about how do we manage that anxiety? How do we quiet that alarm system down that's going off in the brain? I have a number of resources here, and I think there's a resource table out in the break room that you can look at. And I will put these back there at the end of the day. There are a number of workbooks. There are a number, if you want to understand this experience, buy on Amazon some memoirs of people who have been through it. One that I really like is A Quiet Mind to Suffer With. This is written by a Christian. And he talks about the experience of OCD. He puts beautiful words to what this experience is like. So let me just read from A Quiet Mind to Suffer With by John Andrew Bryant. A few paragraphs here. My thoughts are gems and bastards, but it's a stretch to say they're mine. With thoughts this vivid, uncontrolled, and catastrophic, I am rather, it seems, at their mercy. If they are mine, they are only mine in this way. I am the one they are happening to. I am the one who has to see them. I live like a lot of people. I see people, I do things, I eat cereal, I drive a truck, I try to be kind. But I do it with a brain that sends me nightmares every day, thoughts parading down the hall of my mind, vivid images, bizarre and impossible. At turns, these thoughts are random, sexual, and violent. I've had to come to terms with the fact that I have a brain that says what I don't mean, shows me what I don't want to see, horrible things to look at while I'm simply trying to work, eat, and live. You begin to get a sense of what this experience is like. I can't stop this experience. I'm having it. I don't want to have it. And it's an awful experience. By my brain, I have been made to see and feel horrors. I have lived in particular under the vicious regime of three dark and horrible feelings my whole life. I have a brain that says, something is wrong, something is intolerable, something bad is going to happen. In light of those bizarre thoughts and awful feelings, my brain tells me what should happen to prevent those things. Two things that I need to do. You need to do something to be okay, or you have to have something to be okay. So right away, you see the compulsion, the obsession. These thoughts coming into my mind that I don't want, that are incredibly disturbing. My anxiety goes up. I'm going to be responsible for some very bad outcome if I don't do something. And so what do I need to do? Well, there's something, and the brain is going to tell you what that is. You have to do something to stop this. You have to have something to stop this. He goes on to say, those dark and awful thoughts and feelings are, the brain scans have shown, chemicals misfiring in the brain. I have a brain unlike other brains. Now, he states that pretty strongly, and I wouldn't disagree with it, but hear this from somebody who's learning how to cope with that experience. It's helpful for him to say, my brain is doing this to me, and now I've got to figure out what to do with it. My brain consistently, persuasively misinforms. It's always telling me things that are not true. However, those dark and awful thoughts and feelings are not received as data or information or even misinformation. They are consistently experienced as gods, omens, and verdicts, dark prophetic utterances. So his experience of it is not, my brain is doing this, and therefore I cannot listen to it. His experience is, this is reality. Does that make sense? So part of the work, and we'll talk about this more when we get into the counseling side of things, part of the work is to begin disentangling what is that experience of OCD like from the particulars of the experience. So for John Bunyan to be able to say, this is my anxiety, this is my OCD. It's not really that the bell is going to fall down, but I'm feeling anxious about the fact that it is. So how am I going to deal with that anxiety in a way that doesn't perpetuate the OCD process? You with me? People with OCD, when met with the horrible things their brain can show them, just how bad their brain can make them feel, they do things to make their brain stop screaming at them. They obey its command so it will leave them alone. Faced with obsessions, those distressing thoughts and feelings, what their brain says is wrong or intolerable or about to happen, they give in to the compulsion so they will feel okay. They scrub floors, they check things, they create magic numbers or habits to dampen or avoid the verdict their brain has provided. The verdict says life is intolerable, unbearable, something is absolutely excruciatingly wrong, and you must absolutely do something to fix it. It's not just a feeling. It's this bad outcome is going to happen, and you better prevent it. And if you don't, you're going to be responsible for it. He says here, I learned to move in the opposite direction of the greatest perceived needs of my life. The need to figure things out so I will be okay. The need to know for sure so I will be okay. The need to defend myself so I will be okay. The need to go into my head and make things right so that I can be okay. I think that's profound. We'll talk about that more when we talk about the treatment of OCD. He's saying I needed to move in the exact opposite direction of what my brain was telling me I needed to do. That's a difficult thing to do. And I think that if we understand our faith, this is where we get into the integration. If my demand for certainty says I must do this so that I can be okay, right? We can come to the Lord Jesus Christ and say, actually, your death on the cross is enough for me, even if I'm not doing what I should to prevent this. And so I can move in the opposite direction of what feels like the demand is because I trust you, Lord Jesus, and I can do that in faith and engage this exposure or move towards the anxiety or not engage in the compulsion, even though my anxiety stays heightened because I trust you, Lord Jesus. And we'll talk about more specifically what that looks like as we move on here. Maybe just one or two more paragraphs from this. I love Jesus. I am still very much mentally ill. My love for Jesus has not fixed that. Jesus' love for me has not fixed it either. I love Jesus very, very much. And I've still been made to see and feel horrors. I think it's important that we don't give people the impression when we're working with OCD that they're lacking in their faith because they're having this experience, or if they just have enough faith, this experience of OCD will go away. The author goes on, and I would encourage you to buy and read his book, to talk about how his faith was what anchored him in the midst of these horrors and these particular terrors that he was experiencing. And so I believe that our faith can be an important part, is an important part of growing out of learning what it means to deal with this experience of OCD in a faithful manner, in a way that moves us towards the Lord. But we should not set the expectation up that if we just trust Jesus, this experience will go away, or if we still have the experience, it means that we're not having enough faith. Okay, I think what we're going to do is I skipped over common assessments. I will talk about them a little bit, but I want to. We have lunch at 12, and I want to show a 20-minute video clip here of some children. This was sort of a documentary that was done to help us understand what the experience of OCD is like for children. And I think that while the people in this video are children, it is applicable to adults. And it will set up some understanding about what are the particular parts of OCD that we need to understand as we move into counseling. So we're going to go ahead and roll this, and I would like you to watch, see if you can identify particular obsessions, particular compulsions, and notice how the family responds, see if you can pay attention to that, and then what are the things that they begin to do as they move out of this experience of OCD. So this is a documentary called Unstuck. You can look this online. If you want to watch it again, you can pay a couple of dollars if you just Google the Unstuck documentary. Today, we purchased a license to use it for this kind of a training purpose. So we have permission to use it in this manner today. I like that depiction for many, many reasons. Thoughts, questions about that? We have 10 minutes until lunchtime. After lunch, we will jump into... So how do you begin to engage this therapeutically? Yeah.
Is the exposure therapy something that
I will talk about some of the ways that can go off the rails when we get into. I would say you don't have to be a specialist to understand it if you know some of the guidelines. I would be cautious and probably say don't, you know, if you have a child, if you're a school teacher and you have a child that has OCD, you might want to have them work with a therapist, or if you're the teacher, so that you're not doing things in ways that are overwhelming. Get some training or some learning. Don't just jump in and say, okay, we're going to make you touch this dirt. But I will talk about it some this afternoon and provide some of those backgrounds. Yeah, don't be scared. The question was for the recording, do you have to have specialized training in doing exposure? And so I would say get some. You need to understand what's going on. But as lay people helpers, with the help of somebody else, there's no reason that you can't help children to engage. Good question. Other ones? Between OCD and phobias. Good question. How do you differentiate between OCD and particular phobias? Generally, when somebody has a particular phobia, so a fear of a specific thing. So we think of claustrophobia, fear of being in tight spaces, or fear of spiders, or fear of other particular things. That object will provoke the fear. If you have to walk into an elevator and you have claustrophobia, your anxiety might go way up. But generally with phobias, there's not a compulsive process then that you do to make yourself feel better. If you get away from that experience that's triggering the phobia, the anxiety goes down and stays away. It's triggered by that particular phobia rather than kind of an obsessive process that gets stuck in your mind. Good question. So I think I'm hearing you say, how do we differentiate between if there is something like a trauma that's causing the OCD for a child, how do we address that? How do we differentiate between what's really going on? Is it primarily a problem with OCD, or is it more trauma that needs to be addressed? Does that put good words to your questions? Yes. Yes. And generally, when we're working with OCD, there is a, if it's primarily an OCD problem, there is a tenacity to it. There's something that feels a little, I don't want to say otherworldly, but there are definite obsessive processes that are going on and definite compulsive things that they are engaging in to bring that anxiety down. If trauma is causing the OCD, we may do some of the same kinds of therapies to help them manage that obsessive and compulsive process. But we're also going to want to think about, okay, we don't want to miss the trauma, and how are we going to help them understand that as well? So I don't want to give the impression that we just treat the trauma and the OCD goes away. It's more we look at the experience and get to know the person and then say, how are we going to help them manage what's causing the most distress in their life right now? But I don't want to miss this trauma piece that might be going on for them. In the case of the person that I talked about where there was a sexual abuse history and that was causing obsessive compulsive, like, the more I got to know that person, the more it didn't feel like OCD. It felt like, and there are people who have worked with sexual abuse, and when that happens, there are ways we tend to respond. So Dan Allender talks about good girl, tough girl, and I forget what the other category is, but ways our personalities tend to develop as men or women when we go through that kind of an experience. And one of them is the way in which we manage conflict or we manage anxiety or uncomfortability by just doing the right thing. And that can become a bit compulsive. It's just sort of the way the personality develops. So as I got to know this man, it felt less like I have thoughts coming into my mind and they're getting stuck and I've got to do this compulsive behavior, the good behavior, to lower that anxiety. It was more, this is just the way I do life. And so then we started talking about, okay, maybe this has more to do with what's happened to you and understanding that story. So I don't want to give the impression that we have to differentiate clearly one from the other, but it might be more about, as we get to know the person, how do we prioritize what it is that we're going to work on. Is that helpful? Do you want to ask a follow-up question?
What I'm hearing you say is that you actually, with what they're struggling with right now, be giving them tools to lower the anxiety.
Exactly. Exactly. That's right. That would be a good way to put words to it. But we want to think about this person holistically. And if there's some of that OCD kinds of things going on, let's help them manage that. It's not going to hurt them to learn to manage anxiety that way, but I don't want to miss the other pieces that are going on as well. So I use those examples because I want us to have a holistic perspective. But when I think about the people that I have worked with who have OCD, rarely is the trauma the primary focus. It's more an adjunct. And so if we say 100 people that I've treated with OCD, trauma felt like it was a significant thing in a small percentage of those. So I don't want to give the impression everybody that comes in with OCD, we need to be looking for trauma. Just we need to know the person in front of us and understand what all's going on for them. Good question. Okay, one more, and then we will break for lunch. So the question that I think I'm hearing you ask is, how does development in the womb impact a child, and then how do you deal with that afterwards if that might be causing the OCD? Would that put good words to it? So to answer your question outright, yes, there are many ways. There are loads and loads of studies about how the environment that the mother is in while the baby is developing impact the development of the child. I'm not aware, they might be out there, but I'm not aware of any specific studies related to OCD. If the mother is in this environment, we know we're going to get OCD. And I would be surprised if it's that specific. So, generally, what's good for the mom is good for the baby. And so, if you want to think about environments for a mom, think about the things that create healthy, happy mamas. And that's going to generally create healthy, happy babies. When I see somebody that comes in, a child that comes in with OCD or a young adult, rarely do I find it helpful. I don't know if I've ever found it helpful to say, okay, back in utero, this is what was going on. That's probably causing the OCD, and so now that's going to alter what we're doing. We don't know what causes OCD. If we did, we would stop those things, or we would alter something so that doesn't happen. It's probably a multiplicity of factors that come together. And so I don't think about what happened in the womb that's causing the OCD and then make changes based on that. If there are family dynamics that are problematic, or like you saw in this documentary where the family is actually encouraging some of those behaviors, we'll talk about that. How do you recognize that and alter that? So I think I would say, yes, there probably are things that influence it, but we don't know enough, I don't know enough to say this is what you change in terms of treatment based on that.